At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And then he said, but that's, you know, that's the proof that white people don't have privilege. I was like, that's like, we all know there are white people who have horrible lives, white people who struggled. We all understand that. We all understand that. But I don't know. They're stuck in this world where they believe that if you defend a black man, or defend a black woman, or defend the struggle of the black man in America, that means that white people can't have problems, and me. They all go back to me, you know? It's like, yeah, we get it.
RA, can you hear me?
Yeah, is this just audio, or is it photo too? You need to see me, because I don't see you.
Well, you won't be able to see me because the camera's being used by the stream, but if I could see you, that'd be great. Oh, beautiful. Hold on. I can mirror myself because it's kind of awkward just talking to a blank screen.
I don't know how Twitch works, man. Is it on already? Is it going?
We are live right now. So there's some people watching. They are saying hello. Someone said based. That's Twitch speak for good. That means...
Yeah, I, you know, I'm the old man, but I know what based means.
All right. Sorry, say it again. You just cut out.
We can't curse, right? Or we're just not allowed to say saltines.
You're already playing with fire. It's wild. Hey, I'm not the one who made up the rules. It's just everything changed. Let's just say that.
We're not allowed to say or
oh, you can say fuck. You can even say cunt. It's weird. You can say that, but you cannot refer to people as saltines for any reason. You can talk about how you enjoy having soup with crackers. You can say that. That's totally fine. But
be careful, because yeah. When they were talking about a boxing jab, Larry Holmes' boxing jab, they censored that and was like, CVC recommends, you know, they thought it was some kind of COVID talk. And it was like, no, we're talking about a boxing.
How you doing? How is everything?
All is blessed. I've really been having an amazing month. It's, you know, the greatest Christmas of my life. I went through a little dark period, October, November, and I've been just snapped out of it. I've been great, and my kids are beautiful. My daughter's gonna be 6 next month. My son's gonna be 5 in February, and I'm in a like a amazingly positive mindset, you know. But I'm also the up and down swinger, so you know, who the hell knows how long that lasts, you know. So
well, fucking hell yeah, that sounds awesome. Yeah, good for you. That's all you can
really
ask for.
Mind is a good place. Yeah, it's awesome, beautiful. How you doing, everybody? What's up, Twitch? and I'm bad with technology, so like 9,000 screens came up and voices were everywhere, and I just, you know, didn't know what to do. Got rid of it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna try again one day.
You should come. Everyone would love you here. I mean, you've already got like a whole bunch of fans on the left after the whole, you know, incident that took place. But you know, we can talk about that later. I've got like.
On either side, the left and right, when they both, the left will listen to my records, be like, I hate him. The right will listen to my, I hate him. You know, everybody, you know. That's what happens when I'm like, kind of like the Susan Sarandon of rap, you know. So.
That's true. I wanted to, okay. I know we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I have like, I don't know, 5,000 questions I have to ask you about the history.
See me? Can they see my bow and arrow?
They see it all. Every pixel.
Yeah, keep on. You got a million questions. It's all love. It's all love.
Okay. First question is, what got you into hip hop?
Well, Long Island, when I was a kid, it exploded, you know? And my father got me a Fat Boys tape as a joke because I was a fat kid. And you know, I told this story before because obviously that question's been asked before, but... And then there was a kid in my neighborhood who blew up a shopping center window with a Blockbuster, you know, when I caught a stick of dynamite. And I was like, yo, you're crazy. And we ran away. And his name was
Human Beatbox
Bob. He beatboxed. And so we just kept rapping together. And I got better than everybody in my neighborhood and got better than everybody around, you know, on the amateur level at the time. And then the professionals were blowing up, the older kids. There was Eric Sermon and PMD, you know, EPMD and Diamond Shell and Biz. And, you know, Long Island had like this, just everybody blew up. There was like Rakim was the most infamous rapper on the planet. And Public Enemy was coming out of Hempstead and Roosevelt, I believe. And it was like just De La Soul was the year after that. And Prince Paul was in Stetsasonic. So there was just all this hip-hop taking over the planet. Like we were like the best on the planet at the time. So I ended up being better than all the amateurs in the area. Then I started going for the titles of some of the professionals. I met a couple guys with deals. Too Nice, we were going back, and the group was called Too Nice, Glenn Gibbs and DJ Quick, not the West Coast DJ Quick. And that's how I started rapping, just being on the scene, you know.
Were you making mixtapes, or were you like part of like the battle scene too, or did you just get discovered?
Yeah, it wasn't mixtapes. They didn't really have mixtapes. That was more like a 90s thing. You know, I was a fat kid in the 80s, and it was more go. They'd drive you to the neighborhood, or you'd ride your bike to a neighborhood, or you'd take a train to a neighborhood in the city, and it was the battle scene. You'd just go on the block and you'd rap against people. That was what the scene was. It wasn't like, I'm going to make this mixtape, because most people didn't really have access to figure out how to even make songs. You know, we'd kind of like rap into our tape recorder with a microphone, and it wasn't competitive with like a professional record. You know what I mean? Until we found, you'd have to look around for producers or try to hopefully meet somebody that produced or this and that. It was a different game back then. You know, now you got everything at your fingertips. Find 100 producers in 1 second online, you know, and you find 100 producers in one town online, you know. But so it was a different game, you know, a different game.
Total side note, but like, what do you think about that with like people getting discovered on SoundCloud on a daily basis? Do you think it's made the industry better?
You know, it always has ups and downs, because some amazingly great MCs have been discovered and get to make a living and get to grow a fan base. So that's a beautiful thing. And then the flip side of that is when things are oversaturated, some artists aren't getting heard because and they can make amazing music, but I forgot what the number is, but it's what, like 100,000 new songs uploaded a day on SoundCloud. So like, you know, I know this R&B singer in Sweden who really made a couple really great songs, and you know, she posts it up and 1,000 people might hear it, you know, and it's like, damn, you know, like, so but when something does get through it, you know, I don't know. It's just there's ups and downs. The ups is that there's a lot of stuff getting heard that wouldn't have gotten heard. That's an up, you know. So let me turn my heat down a little bit.
Yeah, no worries. Okay. Well, I was going to say I have a really hard question. So I actually wanted to see your facial reaction for it.
I'm not afraid of any of your questions.
All right, question. Who's the best? Well, I was going to say, who's the best member of the Wu-Tang?
Well, I don't know about best, but I think the most charismatic commercial is Method Man. You know, he's great on stage. You know, the women find him attractive. Guys think he's cool. He's got a dope voice, dope flow. He's a good actor. You know, he's definitely the most commercial, and he's very, very good and consistent. He's still good, really good lyrically today, you know. And my favorite on a personal note, like I think somebody who I really hold dear to my heart is Master Killer, because he's the realest dude that you'll ever meet in your life. Master Killer, you know, he's a tough guy, but never talks that tough talk, and is just super respectful. Almost like when I went out to Japan, how everybody's just super respectful, you know, but if you mess with the wrong person, it's like Master Killer reminds me of that. It's just like so respectful. Just don't go the wrong way with Master Killer, you know? So I love him. And Deck, I love personally. I love so many of the guys. You know, I'm really close to a lot of the Wu members. So, and U God, I just became close with his son, Intel. I did a record with him that's out right now called The Gospel. Check that out. Killer Priest is an affiliate, which I think is probably one of the most lyrical human beings that ever lived. So he's a Wu-Tang affiliate, Killer Priest. And he's hilarious because his lyricism is so serious and so, you know, from biblical to painting pictures. And then when you talk to him, he's like a total funny clown, hilarious, one of the funniest people you ever met in your life. So there's a lot of texture to that MC Killer Priest.
Did you ever have the honor of meeting ODB back when he was around?
I'm actually in, I believe it's his final video ever. It was Master Killer, RZA, and ODB did a song together called Old Man. And if you go watch the video, they gave me like a 70s look and gave me like an old 70s. And I'm in the video. They had me flipping hamburgers. I had Wu-Tang sauce and I had all the ladies around me. I believe that's ODB's final video. You know, it was right before he passed, you know.
Was he as funny in person?
He's a wild man, you know. ODB was wild. Even when I didn't know him, I'd see him around and he'd be going crazy. Like there was a place in New York called the Tunnel where all of us went. Like every MC that was anybody was up in the Tunnel, you know. Name somebody from Tupac to Biggie to Naughty by Nature to Redman. It don't matter who it was. They was up in the Tunnel. Everybody was there. And I remember, you know, we're all going into the Tunnel and ODB's front line trying to, you know, fight. Like he was just wild everywhere he went, you know. And there's an infamous story. Dante Ross would tell it better, though. But, like, he was supposed to have a session with LL Cool J at Chung King Studios. It's a legendary New York studio. And LL didn't show up or LL, whatever it was, or maybe LL took too long and ODB couldn't get into the studio. It was something like that. But he took all of LL's plaques off the wall, supposedly, and made a pile of people over them. Go Dante Ross about it. He was there, I think, you know. So if I'm mistelling the story, Dante will tell you, he'll tell you the real story, you know.
Wow. Is it true that you've worked with Biggie?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I've done two records with Biggie.
How did that come about?
Well, we came up together, you know, we were both teenagers, you know, and he had he was just getting ready to put out a song. I think it was the Who's the Man soundtrack. And, the Party and Bullshit was the name of the song. And I had just had a nine bidding war.
This is the proof and Caleb Maulpin and Joke Son Hinkler were dearly missing.
Oh, sorry, you can hear those? Yeah, sorry, those are donations going on in the background. I'll try to turn those notifications off.
You cheap bastards, give this guy some more money. What do I got to do?
Sorry, keep going.
I don't know what I'm allowed to say on this stream. But give the guy some more donations, you know, I don't know. Maybe if he has some white supremacist right-wing talking points.
That's where the money's at right now.
Oh man, come on,
you can't,
donate.
You
come
can't
on,
see it, man. You can't see it, but I'm turning red like a tomato right now in real time.
Yeah, so why do they call you the Serfs if you're one person?
Oh, because there's two of us that do it on the YouTubes, but I'm the only one who streams. The other guy doesn't like to do live stuff.
I gotcha. So kind of like the Young Serfs, the Young Turks. And
yeah, really. Exactly.
He said exactly, yeah. Why you surfers or something? I don't understand. It's, you know, it looked like the Smurfs logo. Sounds like
it was a play on us being plebs. You know, basically, there's lords and there's serfs, and we're the serfs. That's where it came about from.
Oh, I gotcha. All right. Boom, boom, boom. Anything else?
Oh yeah, sorry. Okay. Oh no. On that same topic, I wanted to ask, like, what was it like if you were in the middle of the scene and you're actually like cutting tracks with Biggie when the whole East Coast, West Coast stuff was going down? Because like I'm watching that whole thing as like, you know, a white kid in Canada loving obviously like all this West Coast music at first. And then someone's like, oh, okay, you like Snoop and you like Tupac and all that stuff. You got to start listening to all this stuff out of New York because this stuff is crazy. And then I was like, oh, I love it all. But then the feud started. Like, what was it like being in the middle of that on the other side?
It was still peace at the time. When I was big, it was still peace because Big, you know, the last studio session I had with Big, he had just had the one big record out, the Juicy song, and Unbelievable was the B-side, you know, Unbelievable, but Juicy was blown up on the radio, and he wasn't the giant of hip-hop yet. He was just like, wow, people love Big. They were waiting to see what he had coming, but his biggest song was Juicy, and the album wasn't out yet, and he wasn't a giant yet. So, you know, all that hatred and you know, aggression and anger comes out after everybody's a giant. There's so much ego involved, and East and West, and we're the best, and, you know, Diddy got the best team, and Suge Knight got the best team, and this and that. And it's so it wasn't angry yet, you know, or at least I didn't see that side of it yet. But I started hearing more about it a little bit later. I was more big, was still, you know, had the biggest record in New York, and he didn't even really have money yet. You know, it was like, so, and then a couple of years later, he's on Michael Jackson, or not even, maybe a year later, a couple months, I don't know, it was not long after, he's on Michael Jackson's album, he's on, you know, he's all over the place. He really blew up, because we got to always remember, Big was only 25 years old when he passed, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, he's 24 years old, Pac was 25. So I always bring that up every interview, like, these were kids, man, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, people don't think about it like that. Did you once it actually started getting more violent and stuff, did you feel that this was just the direction that hip hop was going to go in? Like that it was like, you know, because there's always been that clash to me between like, you know, what was considered gangster rap and what was considered like the conscious hip hop, right? And a lot of that was coming out of New York. But then at that point, I felt like everything started accelerating, like Suge Knight and Death Row were putting out so much animosity towards like the East Coast.
I think that it was just publicized more and marketed because it was a selling point. You know, okay. People like beat. So I think the media pushed that, you know, Vibe magazine, West versus East. And, you know, I think it became a media topic because there was always, you know, when you got young kids and they're clashing ego wise, there's always going to be people being run out with guns and stuff. You know, like I tell the story when NWA tried to come to Harlem. You know, I think 89 maybe, and you know, all the real life gangsters said, "You guys ain't gangsters," and they ran them out of Harlem. You know, ran them off the state. You know, all of that stuff. You know, they didn't go East versus West. It was just like, you know, young kid with an ego challenging other young kids with egos. It is what it is. You know, so I don't know. I think the media definitely helped blow the whole. And plus, here's the thing too, though, the 90s. Hip hop became marketed to the whole planet. You know, the 80s, hip hop was still kind of marketed to hip hop heads. And, you know, you had the commercial music was, you know, you'd have like Young MC for MTV and Vanilla Ice in 1990 and MC Hammer in 1990 and like that kind of thing. But like hip hop was KRS-One, Kane, Rakim, Kool G Rap. That was all, you know, marketed to the hip hop heads. You know, and they'd go gold off of people who loved hip hop, where now it's kind of marketed to everybody. And you got to make the pop song for crossover people that don't even care about the culture. You know, it's that kind of world. So in the 90s, so much money was involved that everybody, even the underground rappers were able to sell to become big superstars and become mainstream as could be. Like we were mentioning Wu-Tang. If you really listen to Wu-Tang's album, that's an underground hip hop album. But Loud Records had faith in it and took it and promoted it in the West Coast, promoted it in the East Coast, put, you know, went and did everything. And
are you talking about 36 Chambers?
Yeah. And not even just that. The first single, you know, Protect Your Neck, mm-hmm. and the MPHOD Man on his flip side. Like, I mean, Rifkin worked and worked those records. And then his whole thing, then Mobb Deep in 95 was like, that's the most street record you ever heard, Shook Ones. That's like a legitimate like street record. So hip hop street music was being played at the same level as pop music in the 90s because it was so marketable, you know? So
interesting. Most people, I think, when they think of like, you know, really famous white MCs, obviously they'll mention like Eminem and they might mention like LP and stuff like that. I was curious, what was it like for you? I guess growing up in the scene and becoming as popular as you did and having that racial element. Because I remember when I watched a documentary on how difficult it was for Dre to convince everyone to sign Eminem in the first place, because there was kind of this idea that like marketing a white MC wouldn't sell as well to big record executives.
Yeah, I don't really believe that story.
Really? Wild.
Yeah. I think I got to listen to the interview for myself. But, you know, PR is PR. They have to, you know, I think more what it could have been was Dre at the time was not having, he was on a down slide. He hit a little dry spot. He had like all these big records. And then he did couple records that missed in a row, and he had the Firm album, which was like Foxy Brown and Nas and AZ and like, you know, all the big rappers were on it, and, you know, big production by Dre and Trackmasters, and the album didn't do near to what anybody thought it was going to be. So that could have been more of an issue, you know?
Mm-hmm. But for you, what was it like? Did you ever feel that was, did you feel like you were an outsider working on something that was, like, you know, considered to be like black culture, or is it just a different experience if you are, again, growing up in, you know, Long Island?
No, well, the thing is, I started young and I was accepted young. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'd go to house parties, I would battle everybody in the party. I'd be the only white face, all good, boom, 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 you know. So the black community embraced music, you know. So if you were able to do music and they messed with your music, they messed with you. The race thing kind of came in where, like, white people would be like, "You're not supposed to be doing that. What do you think you're doing?"
It came from white people.
But the black folks was always like, "Yo, he can spit. Yo, that's, you know, if you can do the mute, like, look at Tina Marie, the singer. Like, you know, she could sing. You know, she was one of great soul singers with Rick James and everything. And they embraced her like, you know, nobody even talks color with her. So it's that was more like the community was like, you know, if you could hang and do it, they rocked with you. But like I said, you go, then the white folks come in. You want to be black? You a winger? Christ! And still, you know, after doing the right wing YouTube thing last week and losing my temper, they all wigger. Oh, geez, back in 1985, these want to be black. you suck black this and that. You know, yeah. It's all
wait. That's all the comments that are being levied at you.
Yeah, from that podcast, from after I lost my temper on the pool thing, they were all like, "Oh, but more than that, it's like put the, you know, they think I'm Jewish, so they say put them in the oven, like every horrible thing you could imagine, you know." So it's like that's what happens when you deal with those people. It's kind of weird.
I won't open that up just yet, because I still have a couple of last questions I want to ask you about growing up in that scene. What was some of the best MCs you ever got a chance to work with, and some of the best musical experiences you had?
Well, you know, I worked with all the 90s greats that everybody, like, really, you know, looks up to from the 90s. But my biggest my greatest moments is always my idols, the guys I looked up to. So when I met Rakim, and one time he called me and told me, I met him in person, but he called me to tell me he loves what I'm doing for the culture. He, like, appreciates me so much. And Coogee Rap texted me to say, like, he can't believe some of the lyrical things on my abilities. And he looks, you know, like, looks, and I'm like, "Yo, you look up to what I, like, I worshiped you, man." I still worship him. Like, G-Rap to me is the greatest lyricist that ever lived out of all music. And Chuck D, like, all of my idols, just, and even like Raheem from the Furious Five, you know, he's like, "Hey, you know," all the greats, Grandmaster Caz, just all of those guys, the guys, Master Ace, the guys that I came up on, Kane. Kane has me as one of his favorite rappers. You know, he made it like a little picture with all his favorite rappers, and I was on the.
That's wild.
So every person that I looked up to in music showed me love, like everyone. And those are the greatest moments, you know. A lot of people ask me about, like, the more, like, the famous 90s people because they came up on that. But that didn't mean as much because those were my peers, you know. Mm-hmm. In my mind, those were my peers. The other guys were my idols that I looked up to, you know. So,
yeah. Did you? I just have a couple questions about what is it? Have you ever met Del the Funky Homo Sapien? Did you ever do music with him?
Well, Del is a guy. We both know who each other are. We both pass through the same venues. Like, if I'm doing a show, they'd be like, "Ah, Del's here next week," or they'd be like, "Del was here last month," you know, like, and we know some of the same people, but me and Del never connected. But that's funny. It's like one of the rappers that I never connected with, but there's so many others from that era that are like almost every one of them, you know? So
What is the scene like now for you, being kind of like an old school legend? Is there still like, do you find that there's a lot of respect for the old school in like modern music, or is everyone into SoundCloud rappers and people with face tattoos kind of stuff?
Well, everybody has their separate audiences, you know? So I have a huge following still, and my last album went like number three in the UK, like on the pop charts. And went number 9 in Canada. It was the number 22. This is with like all I have is my computer and my distributor guy, Devin. And like I'll post a video, tweet a little bit. Like we don't have any marketing campaign or marketing team. It's us filming videos, posting them. And we had the 22 biggest selling album when it dropped worldwide on Billboard. And that's all for just doing our own thing with nothing. Like we really have no machine, you know, and doing interviews like this. Hey, will you do it? Yeah, sure. I mean, that's just, I make myself available. I do hundreds of, well, before COVID, you know, I'll be doing hundreds again eventually, but like I do hundreds of shows a year normally and just stay in people's neighborhoods, stay in people's countries, stay around the world, keep showing your face, keep doing, you know, promoting, keep pushing up little music videos, and it stays keeps them wanting more, and you do good every time out. I mean, it's honestly, it's been 3 decades. I started as a little kid, but it's been 3 decades of me being able to not do anything but rap. I haven't had a job, haven't needed a job. I have income coming in from hip hop. There's been dry spots, you know, after I went through the whole label thing in the 90s where I was the bad guy and stuff. I was, you know, struggling, but then, you know, Raucus put me on and started putting me on stages. And then I started touring Europe again, and boom, boom, it all opened up. We were pressing up our own vinyls independently. And, you know, we always, you know, to make a 3-decade career out of what you love and what you wanted to do, we kind of won in life, you know? So,
yeah, I was going to say that's a dream, right?
Yeah.
I'll obviously at the very end, like do some more plugs, but that might be a good time to tell everyone where could they find your stuff if they're watching and they want to.
All My Heroes Are Dead is my latest album. There's videos all over the place, but there's also, you know, Apple, you know, Amazon, you know, wherever you want to go, wherever you usually get your set, name all the famous young people stuff. Name, where do you listen to music, Serps?
Spotify, iTunes, podcast. But no, don't. But I don't want to promote Spotify because aren't they motherfuckers who don't give you like any money? Don't you get like a breadcrumb every day? You know.
I know people can see there's two sides of that story. People complain about that. That's the same thing of what we were talking about. Like, is SoundCloud ruining it? Mm-hmm. People say is by ruining it, but you know, the more people around the world that listen to your music, the more fans you get. Mm-hmm. And the more you book shows and grow off of that and make money. So yeah, maybe they got to listen to it and you didn't make a lot off of them listening to it that one time, but they're memorizing your song, they're learning your personality, they're buying your merchandise, they're connecting with you. So it's almost like if you do a magazine cover. You know, I remember there was a time where Kanye said, we should get paid for our magazine covers because the magazines are selling because we're on them, which I understood his point. But on the flip side is you know, they put you on a cover, the whole world sees that cover and it's a big deal. So it's helping everybody, you know, same thing with going on talk shows. You know, they don't really get paid big to go on Johnny Carson back in the day or the Tonight Show or anything, but you do it because you got a new movie out, you got a new album out, you got a new something out, a new book out. So mm-hmm. So that's how I look at some of those Spotify's. If the numbers go up, that's a good thing, you know, even if if they want to fix it and pay me a whole lot more for playing my shit, hey, I'm cool with that too. I'm not going to stop.
That's kind of what Run the Jewels did, right? They gave away all their albums for free. And then, you know, if you love the music, go see them live kind of idea.
Or they said you could listen to the album free, but if you love it, buy it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
that
people go like, oh, wanted to support it because it was so great and it had such a message that so many people could relate to. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. They my man LP, I know LP too since before, you know, he wasn't even LP yet. He was his name was Roughneck.
Oh, wow. And, that is a long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, I was in North Carolina. This guy, Lou, was like, yo, there's a white boy out in New York, and you live in New York. I don't know why you guys should connect. And I think LP was working at a record store. And so I went to LP's house, and he asked me to do a cameo in his Company Flow video and all of this stuff. And I was actually on the first, I don't know if it was the first Company Flow album, but I was on Fun Crusher, the big classic one that people love, the indie classic Fun Crusher. I was on that album. I was in the studio in the other room, and LP was like, yo, since I got you here, can you do something on my album?
Wow.
So I said, sure. So I just went in the booth and started going, yo, fuck these. Like, I just started cursing everybody out, going crazy. I haven't heard the song in 20-something years, but I know it. A lot of times people are like, yo, you went off when you were screaming at everyone on Fun Crusher. probably look it up at this interview. Yeah, I'm on Crusher Plus, LP out. Well, it's not LP. It's LP and Just, right?
Nice.
Yeah.
I know you're located in Europe. Did the touring and the music scene, like being able to play shows, are they as affected there as we were over here? Because like live music just shut down completely.
Yeah, the whole world's screwy, man. The whole world's screwy, you know. And what happened was I got, you know, the Blue States was all shut down still. And I got this guy who said, hey, I could throw you in all the red states that are open right now. Will that hurt you politically or career-wise if you're playing shows? And I said, no, because the show is not going to be a bunch of rednecks. It's going to be like, you know, hip-hop heads, fun people that want to be, you know, it don't matter. Like, I have no discrimination against a state, you know? And it was all amazing people. So I did about 50-something shows, you know. Well, no. The first one was about 20-something shows, and it was mainly all red. And it was awesome, you know. And the states were red, but not the shows. The shows were hip hop heads. But and then that was successful. So they said, let's do another one right away. And I did another 20 something. And that's when the Blue States started opening. So there was some blue states and some red states. So it was mixed. So I was able to do about 50 shows.
Lance, your trigger phrase is nice and your CIA handler is losing their shit right now just watching you continue to interview RA.
Did you catch that one?
Yeah, thank you. That's the question. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, I gotta throw this out there. How did the Tim Pool interview happen? Did they reach out to you? I know he's probably a fan of yours from back in the day. You were on the Tony Hawk soundtrack. He's a skater boy. Was that the connection?
No, Luke Wadowski, who I was a fan of We Are Change, his website, and we were friends. He came out to New York. I mean, he came out to Berlin. He interviewed me when he was in Berlin, and he was always on top of stuff. And, you know, he come out to New York. I introduced him to my journalist friend, Lindsay Snell. We had dinner with my stepmother. And then Anacapulco was like this anarchy in Acapulco event. And his boy hit me up, Jeff Berwin, I think, or Berwick. And they said, hey, can you make it to this event? Short notice. We'll give you so-and-so. So they paid me to do like a 15-minute set. And it was a really nice, fun time. And in fact, John McAfee was there before they put him in jail. Yeah, it was right before COVID. But so I became cool with Luke. And he hit me up in my inbox, like, yo, come on the Tim Pool show. I said, yeah, sure, no problem, you know. So,
did you know who Tim Pool was?
I've seen him in videos with Luke on We Are Change channel before, like, Tim had a name for himself, really. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, cool. It's Luke's boy, cool, you know, whatever. And I seen a couple videos, and the one I saw, I was like, oh, it's a little bootlickerish, but I didn't go, like, into the whole catalog or nothing. I said, oh, yeah, you know. And then when I was there, they had me up in a hotel, and I started watching the YouTube videos. And because the producer of the show, I forgot her name, she was sweet to me. But she said, hey, watch Tim's show at 10 today, or this and that. I was, sure. Mm-hmm. So, but then I started back looking at some of the other stuff, and there's a lot of stuff I disagreed with on it. So, you know, that's. The thing people, you know, they say, oh, RA's selling out to get a, you know, another fan base of, I don't know what the hell they think, but the easiest thing for me to do, Tim, when I went there, Luke, we're about to go on, and Luke says, hey, this is the 11th biggest podcast on the planet in the whole world. I said, oh, really? Okay. You know,
yeah, he's
the easiest thing to do is there's things that I agree with Tim on, you know, there's a lot of topics I agree with him on, you know, internet, big tech overreach, you know, mandates. I don't know about a lot, but there's a couple things I agree with him on, you know? So the easiest thing to do, you talk about the stuff friendly that you agree with, you know? But,
did he give you topics beforehand? Like before you sat down?
None of that. Nah. But, then I had the videos I saw and I said, nah, we got to talk about that, you know? Cause I hate the fear mongering of critical race theory that happens out of nowhere. Like all of a sudden the whole world's scared that white children are going to hate themselves. And there's this whole thing that they just think that, and they all do it at the same time. They don't understand that this has been fed to them. They've been fed this scary narrative of, you know, black people are, you know, going to be looked at as gods and white kids are looked at as losers. And, you know, it's not, you know, so, and they all have fear and CRT at the same exact moment of time. Like, you know, it's not a year ago, it's all the same time because they've been fed at the same time politically. And they all start, oh my God, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And then they think that people who are scared of COVID are really stupid, but, you know, because they've been fed that by the media. You know, yeah, you're fed that COVID's stupid because the media told you, which I understand there is exaggeration on certain things. There's numbers are messed with. I understand that, you know, but people are dying legitimately. But then all of a sudden, you know, you live in a bubble if you have a concern for COVID, but you don't live in a bubble if you're scared of CRT all at the same exact time. Like all of a sudden afraid of CRT coming to get your white kids. You know, your white kids are gonna hate themselves. Oh, you know, how much suicide is critical race theory causing in us, in our children? I'm sure they're all, oh, I'm a white person. Yeah, you know, I think the white kids are fine, you know.
Well, the thing that's wild to me about that is like it's not even taught in elementary schools. Like the entire idea that like it's going to be taught to your kids. I was like, no, it's not. That's like it's an advanced course for people who are trying to get law degrees. It has nothing to do with elementary school. Like I think right wingers just did a really good job of getting everyone afraid about that.
Yeah, the fear mongering, you know, but they fear monger all of them. The left gets fear mongered, the right gets fear mongered, and they all go into their little shell of fear, and they're all scared. And the problem with the right fear is that they try to make you fear against a type of person, you know, or a type, you know, like with the whole 9/11 for 15 years after that, it was like, or 20 years after that, you know, it was like Muslims are all going to kill you. Muslims, 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 true. Muslims, Muslims, you know, it's like, and blacks, they've been on blacks, they've been on that forever since the beginning of the time. Blacks are bad, you know? So, yeah, so critical race theory is the last thing they want to have their kids hear, you know. And then, you know, they say that what it does is it affects black children are going to believe that they can't make it out of the community because white people are so above them that they just can't make it. That's what black children. So they feed this to everybody and then they start using that like, oh, you're hurting black children. You don't care if they hurt black children. You don't care. Like, because when they kill black children, when cops kill black children, you root the cops on. So why are you acting like you care about the black kids that are here in CRT? So, you know,
so he took that video down and then put it behind a paywall on his website. But then there was a copy on Rumble. So when I originally watched it, and most people, I think, who were watching it for the first time, we only saw about like 20 minutes in the middle, just around where, like, you know, the things are at their like most heated. So yesterday I started watching the whole thing from the beginning because I wanted to start taking notes on how the whole thing went down. And for like the first, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, you're very cordial. Like you're very friendly. He's clearly talking about like a handful of topics, or goes in a handful of directions that I thought, like, you know, most people would have, like, you know, been like, this is something that's trying to provoke me or make something antagonistic or something. I don't know. But then you kind of reached that point where you couldn't really find common ground anymore, I think. 'Cause like when they were talking about gun rights and gun laws, you were, you know, like, and same thing with me. Like, I think people have the right to bear arms. And then Tim Pool will be like, yeah, I think people have the right to own nukes. And like, I don't know how you did that for the first little bit, just to keep everything like on friendly terms. But then it was kind of like around the, I took some notes on this. Yeah, the 36-minute mark, where you started talking about specific killings, and things moved on to the Ahmaud Arbery case, and that's where I think the conversation kind of turned, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, the thing is, gun rights, you know, I'm a little bit on the left on that side. I believe in the gun, you know, gun rights and all that stuff. But you know, I don't know. Background checks, there's all different. I'm not
What
adamant.
does Ari think
Oh,
is under the
keep
beanie?
the gun.
Another
But the thing
beanie,
is,
tinfoil.
I do gun rights, you know. So, and you know, the fear of, oh, they're taking our guns, you know, there's a little truth to that sometimes, you know, because there is some people that want to take your guns. It's true, you know, and some people would believe that's a good thing because look at America with this gun nation. But you know, my thing is, firstly, get the guns out the streets somehow, you know. But yeah, but then he starts going overboard saying, yeah, I think they should have nuclear weapons. I think we should be allowed to have nuclear weapons. And you go, you know, I don't know about this conversation. I don't know where to take that. So you let him have his say. You go, yeah, okay. You say, I don't really, you know, think that's maybe they need. And he's like, well, if you change that, you're changing the Constitution. I said, well, maybe you change the Constitution. And if you think, you know, we should give regular crazy people a nuclear weapon just because if they could afford it, you know. So yeah, and then I brought up critical race theory, and he started, you know, oh, they gave a white person a tail or something. He said the white people are the devil, and who are these people? It's like, and he's doing what he accuses the media of doing, where like they take little parts of something and they sensationalize that one thing and pretend that's the whole package and that's what it really is. And they'll look for one, the media will look for one moment where like somebody does something terrible, and then they'll promote that terrible act, and that's what it, the whole, and there's, you know, they don't look past reality. They don't try to look at reality. They look for the agenda and the quick little talking point moment, and they shove it down your throat. And so yeah, it got a little crazy. Got a little crazy. Yep.
How do you think things pivoted to talking about like Tim Pool's lived experience? How did it evolve into that?
Because he's the thing is, they kept saying, "Oh, I'm a journalist." But then he would not have the facts because he brought up Ahmaud Arbery, and then I said, well, yeah, there were other people going through the house. He wasn't. He's like, no, that's not true. That's not true. There weren't other people in the house, but there was, and you know, the owner admitted there was, and there's footage of other people in the house, you know. So he's the journalist. I'm just the rapper. So, but why is he shutting? No, there's not. There's not. There never. Go look it up. It's real. You know what I mean? So that's the thing. I knew I was dealing with something that was like only looking at one side of a thing and not looking for truth, you know, but they claiming to be the truth, the truth. So it was a little concerning. And then we're talking about critical race theory. We're talking about the murder of black people by policemen. And so, but my experience, my experience, my experience. And that's the opposite of what we're supposed to do if we're talking about it. But that's almost like, hey, you know, cancer is killing my grandmother. And you go, but my experience is my, no, we're talking about cancer right now. Why, my, me, you know? So, and he kept bringing it to him about everything, racial profiling in the airport. Me. No. That's why I was laughing. That's what made me laugh. Like, dude, come on. We're talking about racial profiling. You're me. Dude, like, we're talking about real problems. But there was this thing where he brought everything back to him. So that's why I started getting laughing and laughing and laughing, you know, like, come on, and kind of but his fans aren't, don't, they don't understand things. They don't understand anything, you know. They think they're smart, but they're in their little bubbles. And they think everyone else is in a bubble, but they're in that one lane bubble. They only want to hear what they want to hear, you know.
Did you find it weird that you were the one being called racist, even though you were trying to explain to him the concept of whiteness, I guess?
That was a tactic. That was the same tactic. Like I'm defending people of color and brown people, and he's you don't believe that I'm racially profiled. You're racist. It's a smear tactic. It's a distraction to reality, because he makes it about himself again. In no way anyone rational would go, oh, that's a racist thing to think Tim Pool's not racially profiled at an airport. Like, no, maybe they stop you because you're Tim Pool. Maybe they stop you because whatever, but you're not racially profiled. That's a fact. But, you know, they want to swear it's about them. And here's the problem, too, is that so he has I think he has a Korean grandparent or something. So then he'll use that to get away with pushing kind of right-wing talking points and getting away with it, you know, like, oh, okay, boom, boom, because of this and that. And I experienced racism. So black people, you know, I don't know, you know.
No, I get what you're saying. Like, I don't think, like, personally, I think, like, his lived experience is his lived experience, obviously, you know, but no one can kind of take it away, whatever it was. But I don't think that shields you from what you do for a career, right? Which is to make people really afraid that a civil war is coming. And that's what Tim Pool does. That's kind of his entire track record on YouTube.
Yeah, but here's the thing is when you're kind of belittling the experiences of a guy that was murdered by the cops and trying to say, oh, look, he was on drugs, or criminal. If you look at the past tapes and stuff, or Breonna Taylor, they're lying to you about it. You know, all of this stuff, it makes you have less sympathy. You go, guy, come on, look at you. You know, so maybe my reaction to that, hey, look at you, you know, you, white guy, you know, but it is what it is, you know. You're fighting for the good cause. You're fighting for good people. So when you make enemies with people that are really lousy people, like if you go and read the way these people talk, his followers, it's like, wow, these people are really, really disgusting and evil, you know. So, yeah.
Did you see that he made a response video to you after the TYT thing?
No, I didn't see that one. But that's another thing. It's like his fans don't don't look at the whole story. What happens is I lost my cool, and I knew, like, oh, come on. You know, you lost your temper. Chill. Just chill. The guy quieted down. Just chill. He got respectful. After I lost my cool, he was respectful the rest of the conversation. We kept it respectful. Peace. Hugged it out. Boom. Took off. He said, hey, come back anytime you want, blah, blah, blah. So then when I left, I go online. And then he wrote this really sweet tweet, like, oh, everybody's just seeing the fight that me, the quote unquote fight where we had that moment. He said, Ari's a legend, and nobody's posting the part when we hugged it out at the end. Okay, cool, you know?
So I said,
So I said, respect, peace. You know, I lost my temper. I got to work on that. I was wrong for that. Respect Luke. Respect the producer. You know, blah, blah, blah. So, and then like a day later, he makes a response to the fight and says, the fight, whatever. Mm. He makes a response and says something like,
clean up your room. Oh.
No, he said, you know, Ari's a great guy. He's great. He's great. And look at his response, the apology. That's awesome. What an awesome guy. And he goes, the thing is, though, he doesn't believe that I'm, you know, he says the saltine word, and he doesn't believe that I'm racially profiled. I don't know. Don't quote me exactly what he said. But then he starts saying, he's racist. That's the only problem. But he's a good guy, but he's racist. Like, if somebody's racist, you're going to be, he's a good guy. You know what I mean? But. So he starts calling me names on his thing. And Cenk did a video, you know, and Sam Cedar and all of these guys, they did videos going like, damn, like Sam Cedar, they said, this guy, you know, got sunned, you know, and he got destroyed about police brutality because Ari's speaking facts, you know. And so Cenk was like, hey, we had Ari in the past. Maybe we'll have him again. So I was in L.A. I said, yeah, I'll come up to the program. You know, I'm not thinking like this. And so now all is, oh, you backstabbed Tim because you apologized. And then you went on the Turks. I'm like, yo, I went on Talib Kweli the day before Tim Pool. I went on Tim Pool. 2 days later, I go on to the Turks. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, The Daily Caller, the Tucker Carlson, thing. It was a show. Really cool guys, man. It was like a lefty and a righty, and we had a respectable dialogue. I forgot what their names are. Forgive me for this, but they really was a good show. And then today I'm on the Surfs, so I'm not. So what is it? I'm going on Tim Pool and then never do a show again. That's not the same audience as Tim Pool. Like they're just living in this bubble world of non-reality, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'll make a confession. When I first watched it, I was laughing my ass off because I thought at first that Tim just didn't get it. Like I was like, you're not in any way trying to disparage him for his race. You're trying to explain to him, and he's not understanding this, how people will perceive him as being white in society. Like people just like I'm half indigenous, but if you looked at me, you'd be like, that's a white boy, right? Like I'm very outwardly white. So I thought that's all that was trying to take place, but it just kept accelerating to him trying to have to explain, like, this is my lived experience, which to me sounded a lot like someone who kind of grew up in, like, you know, a middle income, initially went to a private school, then went to a public school kind of stuff. But, like, afterwards, I had some time to calm down because the whole thing was such a big event on the internet, and I was thinking about it, and I was like, maybe I shouldn't laugh at the Tim Pool like lived experience part of it or whatever I did, and try to figure out why it is, because you just said his fans and the people who work with him, or sorry, the people who watch him, they're not getting it either. And I think what you're trying to explain to people is really important, right? You're not trying to explain to them that they are lesser than because of the race or anything like that. You're trying to explain that society will perceive you as white and you will be treated differently because of that. The same way people are treated differently because they're black. Black, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, here's the thing: they don't understand any of that, because I've seen a comment on where they said, "Yeah, we all know that RA lived this terrible life and had this and that, and his kids died, this died, that died, the boom, boom, death and poison and poor fat, boom, 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 boom," and then he said, "But that's that's the proof that white people don't have privilege." I was like, "That's." We all know there are white people who have horrible lives, white people who struggled. We all understand that. We all understand that. But I don't know. They're stuck in this world where they believe that if you defend a black man or defend a black woman or defend the struggle of the black man in America, that means that white people can't have problems. And me. They all go back to me. You know, it's like, yeah, we get it. I've been through the struggle. You've been through. We got that. But it's a different struggle. And it's not because of the color of your skin that struggle. You're not, it's a totally different struggle. It's something different. So if we're trying, like I said before, if somebody has lung cancer, we're not going to address somebody's cut finger at them. Okay, we're not going to be like, oh, his cut finger's worse than cancer. We're not talking about that right now. We'll put a little Band-Aid on it for you. Cool. And let's fix this cancer, I don't know.
Well, yeah, you can be oppressed for so many things as a white person. Like, you can be oppressed by being poor, or you can be oppressed by being like a gay white person or whatever. But just one of the things you're not oppressed for is your race, broadly speaking, white. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you, like, is it going to continue, do you think? Is this feud, are you going to respond to the response, or are you just kind of like, I'm just going to let it be, not think about it, move on?
Well, I've moved on, but right now it's a hot topic for the internet. So like when I do an interview, somebody's going to go, hey, what happened with the Pool thing? Right. So you go, okay, boom, boom, boom. So you discuss it, I don't even have a response. I didn't even look at the video he made. I saw the first one before the Turks, and then he made like a couple after the Turks, I guess, because people, hey, I didn't see them yet. Like, I'm not, let me see what he's saying about, like, at this point, it's like, well, I'm pretty confident he's not going to be trying to say good things about me. And I don't care. It doesn't affect my life. I have a life, and internet drama isn't really something that I care about, So
how's the backlash been in terms of, like, you said you're getting quite a bit of people from like the far right mad at you for what happened. Is that pretty much the biggest? Are they the biggest group that are going after you now?
But even that, you get some jerks going, calling you names on the internet, some jerks like, oh, and calling you racist things and saying horrible things and death threats and all. It's little internet trolls. You know, it's not a real life situation. You know, I'm good. So.
But sorry, just one last question about the Daily Caller thing. Were they interested in talking to you about like this issue, like the issue of like race and stuff like that, or was it just bring you on because you're hot on the internet right now?
Well, the one guy inboxed me, and I sent it to you too. I said, "Yo, is this are these guys going to try to set me up?" And then at
Well,
some
right away I was
point,
like, that's Tucker Carlson's outfit, just so you know.
you were like, "Yeah, they might," you know. And then at some point, I said, "You know, what are they going to set me up? Like, what are you going to say mean things to me? I don't care. Right now, I'm frozen. I'm gonna try to look what the interview's called real quick because they were nice guys. So I'm just trying to look that up real quick." But where is it? Here, let me see. Give me one second, right?
Yeah, no worries.
I'm just trying to see what the show was called. It was called Jesus, give me a second. How Media Echo Chambers Are Destroying America, guest Ari the Rugged Man. The show is called Save the Nation, episode 77. And the host is Vince and Jason. Let me see if as a commercial on. But yeah, you get the idea. You could go look it up. But it was a good interview, and it was about tons of topics. It was about a whole bunch of topics, from everything from boxing to movies to Vince Coglianese and Jason Nichols. Those are the two hosts. Yeah, had a good time on that one. Yeah.
Cool.
Is this boring? Is this boring? We should do something fun. If it's Twitch, isn't Twitch like video games and strippers and wild stuff?
It's mostly strippers now. It's like 99% strippers. That's all of Twitch. Twitch is like it's video games and it's just people yelling at each other. It's a lot of that. It's a lot of angry people yelling at each other now.
Yelling at each other. We're boring. Should I start yelling? I can't see your face, so I can't yell at you.
It's true. Just start calling me names. I guess one of the last things I wanted to ask you is that are you? I know obviously you've always been somewhat political, just by the nature of the fact that you are a poet and a musician and that kind of stuff, right? So there's going to be that element. Are you now? Do you think getting pulled into this kind of online world of politics because of what happened? And is that something that you'd want to explore?
No, I've always been there. I've always got calls from the political sites. I've, you know, from my life experiences and the things I've been through and the stuff I talk about, you know, I always get the same, you know. It's not like all of a sudden I had a fight or like a argument with a YouTuber, so now I'm going to change everything and be put. Nah, my life is exactly the same, exactly, and my song lyrics are exactly what I write. You know, it's not a. It didn't change a damn thing, you know. So,
Can I ask you two questions from the chat? Because people have been asking me to ask you some questions.
of course, you could ask you. I'm, you know, you set this up, and I'm here for you. So you got me.
Thank
Yep.
you. One of the first ones I think is going to be controversial, but what do you think of Jimmy Dore?
Well, I don't think it's controversial. I think that's an honest one. You know, I was a fan of Dore for years. You know, I met him in 2016 briefly at the Young Turks when he was still there, and Jill Stein was speaking, and so I went up to see Jill Stein speak and say what up to everybody, and I started following him and checking him out, and I liked a lot of the stuff he talks about, and I know it's controversial, but I believe Aaron Matei and Jimmy's work on Russiagate, I think it's official. I agree with them more than most on that. I believe that it was a political scam, you know? And a lot of people on the left are going to disagree with me on that. But like, I believe Russiagate was this big hoax that was presented to act like the election was this big stolen event. But if you dig into it, it's like some Facebook ads from somebody that's not a Russian government. It's just like, so, and then they blew it up, and you know, and the Steele dossier was funded by, you know, who was funded that, you know,
Well, I was going to say, of all the things you could agree with Aaron Matei on, that one is probably going to be one of the least controversial. I think it's libs who would be mad at you for saying that, not so much the left.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And so yeah, there's things that I agree with Jimmy on. I followed his Russiagate reporting and Aaron Matei's reporting a lot. And also Aaron Matei interviewed Lindsay Snell, who I told you about, who's a good friend, the one that I introduced to Luke. She's the one that was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda and thrown in a Turkish prison. And they said that she was the CIA. And she had a tough time, but she's free and she's back doing journalism. And Aaron Matei interviewed her. And yeah, so I kind of, I'm a fan of what they do, but I don't like the video he made, you know, with, look, Kyle Rittenhouse and stuff like that. I kind of thought, like, come on, Jimmy, where are you going these days? You know, so, you know, but that's the thing with politics is you're allowed to be like, you're allowed to disagree with people on stuff, you know, you're allowed to, you know.
True.
You know, I don't think that Jimmy, but, you know, I don't know him personally, but I don't think Jimmy's the type to, like, start pushing the reason why certain murders of black men are reasonable and accurate and correct. But I don't know. The Kyle Rittenhouse video he made, he was trying to show, like, look, this is how it really went down. But he was also leaving out a couple points here and there. So, you know, but everything's up for debate. You know, it's the thing is when everything, every topic you promote, like what I was talking about, the Tim Pool thing on other show, it was like what kind of got me a little crazy was like, you know, pro-blackness, black power is wrong, Kwanzaa's terrible, CRT's terrible, Derek Chauvin's nice, you know, Breonna Taylor, they're left lying to you about it, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, they grabbed the gun and he was, you know, and I also believe that because him and Luke tried to tell me that the other guy went to prison just for filming. And I have to look into it more.
But, oh, in the report, he was trying to block him with his truck, apparently.
Yeah, but they didn't tell me. They're supposedly the journalists, but they said, so you're okay with him going to jail just for filming. So I'm there going like, that's really what that, they just filming, you know, because, I'm looking at Luke like, okay, these guys, you know, I wasn't up on that. But like, why are you going to leave out the fact that, no, people saying, no, he was blocking the guy. And you know, there's more to it than that. So, but I'm not, you know, so when every single thing piles up in a favor against certain people, you start going, come on, guys. Jimmy, to me, isn't at that point yet. But there's a couple videos that I disagree with, you know, so.
Other question, have you gotten involved in any political controversies before the Tim Pool event?
Oh, yeah. My whole career is a effing controversy, you know. One time, you know, in the beginning, I called Obama used car salesman. Everybody got mad at me, you know, like, yeah, it's always been. Yeah, because I kind of just say what's in my head, you know, I say what's on my mind, and I don't do PR management. I just, or PR school, you know, I just kind of, blup, 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 this is how I feel. And then, you know, the whole half the world gets mad at me, you know, so, yeah.
And then the last question, will you do a hot tub stream on Twitch?
What does that mean? Me in a hot tub with some chicks or something?
It could be that. It could be just you. It could be whatever you want, but it's you in a hot tub in your room kind of thing.
Do people usually do that? Is that what you mean?
Okay, so there's this thing on Twitch where you can't be in a bathing suit unless you're technically in a pool or a hot tub. So people started putting kiddie pools in their rooms so they could stream in bathing suits or be shirtless. And then it was a way of getting around the rules. And so it just became a thing. So now it's called hot tub streaming.
That's so bizarre. You know, put me on an old man page because, you know, the young kids got to figure that stuff out. I don't understand anything, man.
Well, that's what the kids call being a boomer, right?
But yeah, I'm just confused. So, but they're allowed in a bathing suit if they're in a tub or something. That's it.
Yeah. So,
but
if there's, the rules get really weird. Okay, so technically, you can't be shirtless if you're a woman or if you're female presenting. You can only be shirtless if you're man or male presenting, and you can't be shirtless unless you're technically in a pool or a hot tub. And so again, people started making kiddie pools in their bedrooms so they could be shirtless on their streams and stuff like that. And it's allowed.
So women are allowed topless?
No, they're not.
Oh, just the men if they're in a tub. So what can the women do in a tub?
They can be in bikinis, but they couldn't do that normally if they're not in the hot tub.
Well, what if they're on a beach? They can't stream from the
I
beach.
I think they're allowed to do it on the beach. There's like some exceptions. They've got weird rules for that. Or what art. They can get home? they can be painted naked, but they can't show nipples or vagine.
So bizarre. Yeah.
We live in a weird world. Glad,
when OnlyFans, remember they tried to take the nudity off of OnlyFans?
Oh, that was ridiculous.
I don't even do OnlyFans, but I felt so bad for so many women. I know so many women that get paid from that and do make good money off of it.
Oh, yes. I was going to say sex workers are the ones that made that company. Like, what would OnlyFans be without sex workers? You know?
Exactly. Well, that's my issue with, you know, this is something that, you know, the pool group and all of them would agree on, is that was my problem with YouTube, was that, you know, they built their backs on everybody allowed to have an opinion, you know, mm-hmm. and became one of the biggest companies in the world off of just letting the public talk. Mm-hmm. So then when they start kind of like strikes and taking people down for certain opinions, I started going, you know, that's a little funny style. So I'm on their side about that one issue, you know? So,
everyone, by the way, loved your answer to the hot tub question. So that's good.
Bullet hole the MC from.
Oh man. RA, I honestly, oh sorry, go ahead.
Pay the serfs to get me like some internet lessons or something. Give him some tips and he'll pay somebody to train me in Twitch and all what you young kids are doing, you know.
Hell yeah. Hey, I'll help you get set up on Twitch if you want. That's easily the way I could repay you for all this.
I don't even know what I would do on it yet. Like I said, I tried. I'd like to screen movies and stuff, but you can't even do that, right?
Yeah, you can. You just have to do them through Amazon Prime because Amazon owns Twitch. But you could. There's also a huge music scene. Like, there's a lot of like MCs who just do like live shows and stuff on Twitch too.
No, I would rather do like, you know, Mystery Science Theater type of shit where me and my friends just talk about movies that nobody ever seen before.
Hell yeah.
I'd like to do that.
You could do it for movies that don't have copyright too. Like the copyright expires, like, you know, Night of the Living Dead, movies like that.
Yeah, you name the most famous one that everybody does, you know, Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, yeah. I feel bad for George Romero because of that. You know, imagine making like the most famous zombie film in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And one little thing you did wrong with the copyright, and you know, he would have been 100, 200, 300 millionaire. You know, he would have been worth so much money, and his one screw up in life, man. So, rest in peace, George Romero. He was a legend and one of the greats. But
agreed,
that's a story. Yeah, but yeah, all right. So
awesome, RA. Honestly, I cannot thank you enough. That was fucking amazing to finally talk to you. Like, thank you so much.
I'm in Germany and I was up early in the morning, so I'm a little tired. So if I seem like I lost energy, next time I'll be naked in a hot tub. So,
hell yeah. Hey, where can everyone find your stuff and support you and give you the monies?
You tell them where to go. Go everywhere. RA the Rugged Man. Just
so all you Zoomers, wherever you get your music, you know, on the interwebs, everywhere music is sold. RA the Rugged Man .net. Go buy some merch. Go buy some vinyls. Buy some vinyls and listen to it on vinyl, because that's the way it's meant to be listened to. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, no. If you don't have a record player, just, you know. But drawing is awesome on it. But yeah, so All My Heroes Are Dead is the latest project, and I'm very, very, very proud of it. I put a lot into it. So yeah, everybody, I hope the audience was had a good time, and I'll get the hang of this Twitch thing soon. All right.
Yeah, reach out. I'll help you set up your Mystery Science Theater show.
All right, peace, man.
All right, bye. That was awesome. Finally spoke to RA the Rugged Man. That was fun.
Clean up your room.
Oh, and good news, everyone. The show just started. Okay, I got to give a lot of thank yous for all the donos and things that were popping in at the most inappropriate time. Can I add, at the most Saki Tanuki, at the most inappropriate time. I can't remember what we were talking about, but then all of a sudden it's like, clean up your room. I mean, the timing was kind of funny, but you know, there was that. All right, let me try and turn. I tried to disable donations, but I'm going to try and turn them back on now, so they pop up. Oh, thanks, No Rain. Everyone go check out No Rain's channel.
Response and says something like,
clean up your room.
Oh, no. Oh, no. That's too perfect.
Response and says something like,
clean up your room. Oh.
No, he said, response.
Oh, no. Oh, man. I gotta download that one. When the dono hits just right, you know? So you've just been listening to an episode of The Surf Times, and if you enjoy it and want to see The Surf Times, you can go to wearesurfs.com or watch the live shows at thesurfs.tv. And also everywhere social media is sold, basically thesurfs.tv, you'll find us there, twitter.com/thesurfstv, for example. It would also help us out tremendously if you could leave a good review of this podcast if you enjoyed it, either on, I don't know, iTunes or wherever you're podcasting. Apparently it does help, and yeah, we hope to see you soon.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Just, we beseech thee to smite down our enemies. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, we are but your humble court jesters here to amuse you. To our lords, Trevor R., we give thanks for this spit of land for us to eke out this meager existence. To our knights, Merid, Cheryl Alvarez, Ruby Kelly, Ellie Leslie, Alex P., Brandon, Words Greenwood, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariane McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Coulter Smith, Val 9000, Jenna Tall, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Omni, Riley and Anna, Poodle Hawk, The Tim Caucus, Multi Mondi, Trevor Yanis, Lemmy 101, Anthropophojack, Cern 42, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Nkosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We raise our flagon of ale, and we salute you, our friends.